Kathy Shreve. Today's date is April 7th, 1975, and the time is 7 p.m. I will be interviewing Stephen Smith, Saginaw, Michigan. The topics to be discussed are the facts he finds most interesting about the Saginaw Valley and the aspects of education he thinks are important in teaching the history of the Saginaw Valley. Okay, gotta make sure it's one of these. How far back does your knowledge of the Saginaw Valley go?
You mean as far as period of history or how?
Yeah.
Oh, probably I'm most familiar with the early exploration, fur trapping, things like that. A little bit during the logging industry and things like that. I've lived here for probably 23, 24 years or so. And as far as the actual knowledge of it, not that long. I haven't devoted that much time to studying it, but probably back into the period of trapping and things like that is what I'm most familiar with. Mm-hmm.
Where did you get your education on it, or how did you find out about it? Was it something you did on your own, or was it a class?
Classes that I've taken, most of it just from talking to people who lived around here for a long time. A lot of old-timers in hunting and fishing and things like that have run into people who've been around the Saginaw Valley for a long, long time, and their parents were, and, you know, spinning yarns. I don't know how much of it's true and how much of it is not true, but, you know, pretty much hearsay, I guess.
What kind of facts, or can you think of anything offhand that they told you that really especially interested you or that you really remember?
I think probably the thing that always has impressed me most about it is the different outlooks that the different countries who shared at one time or another, as I'm sure you're aware, possession of Michigan, how the French came in and must have been a very unbigoted bunch of people. The English tried to subjugate the Indians, so did the American settlers, but the French treated them as brothers, lived with them. Of course, I'm sure you're aware during the French and Indian War, the French and the Indians were allies. The way in which the French trappers and mountain men lived has always been very interesting to me. Being driven northward into and being forced to settle in Quebec after the Revolutionary War and later wars, they really made friends with the Indians. I think they treated them as people and didn't attempt to corrupt them like the whites did. The whites tried to convert the Indians to their way of living with the white man's goods and things like this, where the Frenchman more or less was interested in living with an Indian on the Indian's level.
Mm-hmm. Did it surprise you at all? I don't know if that's the right word. But do you think they might have discovered Michigan by accident because they came up through the river channels up farther north? Do you think it was just an accident? Or?
Yeah, I think pretty much it was. Of course, all exploration or any discovery is really accident. You hope there's something out there, but you don't, you're not going to bet the farm on it. Of course, I'm sure you realize that when the landmass in North America was discovered, nobody had any idea how wide it actually was. Mm-hmm. Even up into the 1803 or 1804 Lewis and Clark expedition, they were still trying to find a river system that would get them all the way across North America. Of course, this is impossible, but the Hudson River and what's now the St. Lawrence Seaway and the Great Lakes looked probably like a natural to them that they could travel by water, which was the only way of transporting goods. Men could move over land, but getting any large amount of goods was necessary to have ships and channels. And interesting thing about Michigan, I think, is that it went untouched when other areas were being explored.
Yeah, that was my next question. Why do you think they waited so long? Do you think it was just because of the disease that was here?
Well, of course, you know, the disease of the swamplands that Michigan was based on at that time was actually pretty isolated. From what I understand anyway, well, I've traveled in practically every state of the Union, and every state seems to have brings to mind one idea. For example, to me, if I think of North Dakota, I think of flat cornfields. If I think of Oregon, I think of mountains. Where Michigan is a very diverse topography, not the climate so much, but you've got places out in the Thumb, for example, that are as flat as Nebraska. You've got places in the Upper Peninsula that look like the subarctic regions. You've got river systems and lakes And I guess a lot of it depended, I think, on where the explorers landed. If they happened to land out in the thumb, they might think, well, you know, big deal. It's just another hunk of flat land. But if they landed in the Traverse City area, for example, and saw the terminal moraines left by the glaciers, they might think of it entirely different terms. I think that had a lot to do with why they just ignored it for a while. They probably hit on one section and experienced disease and death and even hostile Indians and thought of it as all of it as being that way, and they just bypassed it because, unlike any other area that was to become a state, it was very easy to bypass because of the water systems. You could go, you know, from present-day Detroit to present-day Chicago and never set foot on land.
Yeah. Do you think that the logging industry, I don't know whether this, I don't know that much about the rest of the United States, but was there any kind of logging facilities over the rest of the United States? Or was that kind of something that really got more developed when they got into wooded areas like Michigan?
Yeah, first of all, when they did hit the North America, as far as actual logging, was not really, it happened to, I don't know how you say this, the need for wood happened to coincide with the real exploration development of Michigan's logging industry, lumbering industry, because of the fact that in the Civil War period, shortly after, and even before that, of course, there was a lot of building taking place. It coincided identically with the settling of the Great Plains. As you're mm-hmm. probably aware, the Great American Desert, as it was called, was bypassed by people. People used to seeing trees, they thought in terms of trees meaning fertility of the soil, and so they passed right over the present-day states of North Dakota and South Dakota and Kansas and the rest of them in an attempt to reach what they thought were more fertile grounds to the west. And then the gold rush moved more people out there. Well, when they finally decided that, you know, the plains might be a pretty good place to grow crops and to consequently build homes, there was nothing really to build them out of. And Michigan's logging industry then came to be, or at least reached its high point then. Now, where I used to live, just to show you kind of how widespread it was, where I used to live in Washington State, there is a town named Saginaw, Washington, named after, named after the Saginaw that we know, because of the fact that, they just moved. It started in Michigan, I guess would be the easternmost region of lumbering, and it went from there to Wisconsin and Minnesota, across the plains to Oregon and Washington in the Douglas firs, unlike the white pine we have had here. The Douglas firs of the West Coast, and these people would move lock, stock, and barrel, up to the next place. But it kind of had to get its start here. The East was pretty well settled, too settled for any kind of large logging.
I guess what I'm getting at is, do you think that the reason maybe people didn't settle at first, if it wasn't largely because of disease, was because they didn't know how to use the natural resources that were here?
Now, that's true. See, what a lot of people don't realize is that Michigan's soil, until those trees were cut down, not only could the sun not reach the forest floor and grow any kind of small plant. The white pine is a climax coniferous forest, which means nothing will take it over, barring some kind of natural man-made disaster. The white pine will survive. The jack pine and other serral stages will eventually be replaced by the white pine. Well, what happens is, it's a little bit technical, but basically what happens is when rain falls on pine needles, the acid in the pine needles dilutes any kind of acidity and basically nitrates in the soil, and it carries them down about 18 inches, where they finally solidify into an inch or two-inch layer called hardpan. And that lays, like I said, about a foot and a half below the surface. Well, it prevents rainwater from moving off, and it also causes a sterility in the soil because of these pine needles. Mm-hmm. Well, when the white pines were down, the pine needles eventually lost their acidity through constant rain and snow and forces of erosion, and eventually the land was proved very fertile. But as far as being fertile while the trees were there, it was not. In other words, you couldn't cut a hole in the forest and grow a real Jim Dandy crop of corn. It just wasn't in the cards. It took several years after that. And of course, Michigan, for example, what used to be called the prairie farm out by St. Charles, Just a few years ago, was rated an 80-acre section there was rated one of the three most fertile plots of farmland in the entire world, and which it couldn't have been before this.
Mm-hmm.
And the logging industry, it paved the way for farming. It had to. Unfortunately, they kind of went at it a little bit too gung-ho, but you know, they thought it was inexhaustible. We can't really blame them for it. You know, hindsight is always 20/20.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does.
Kathy.
The Sauk Indians, I know, were the first to settle in this area. Do you think that's why they didn't stay, because they're kind of a nomadic tribe? It was because at that time there wasn't any?
Yeah. The Indians who lived in Michigan pretty much were, as you said, nomadic. They really had to be. The forests were just too much for them. They were much more content to live off vegetation that was growing already. You know, I mean, the nuts and berries syndrome, if you will, and fishing and hunting, which was fantastic and still is, by modern day standards, a very good area for sportsmen. The fact that they had grown up, I'm sure, with these huge trees and farming was just not in the cards for them, led a pretty good life, traveling shorelines and river systems mainly. They had wintering grounds and summer grounds, and of course any kind of a natural break in the forest would produce a lot of low-growing shrubs, which perhaps you're aware are the ones that produce food edible for humans. By the way, the Indians used to take the inside bark of the white pine tree and boil it up and make tea out of it. They'd slice one hunk of the bark off, and they say it could even be eaten raw, and it was very nourishing, although it didn't taste too good. I've never tried it.
I've had some of the white pine tea.
I'll have to take your word for it.
Yeah, I thought it was bitter.
Yeah, well, I think regular tea is bitter, too.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, just kind of getting on to a different area. Do you ever, I know that you, I probably say this for the sake of the tape, you teach in a parochial school, and it's fifth and sixth grade, right?
Right.
And is it primarily history?
Well, it's two-thirds science and one-third history.
Okay. Now, I know when I had you, that's what I had you for.
Right.
But in your teaching, do you ever bring in the history of the Saginaw Valley and the history of Michigan in general?
Yeah, I do. The way it works is junior high, actually, in our school, is the American history, and I take ancient history up to and including a large part of the age of exploration. In junior high, they attempt to get into more of the exploring of North America. What I try to do is set up the reasons for exploration, you know, collapse of feudalism, expanding trade, and consequently attempts to find shorter routes from here to there, which resulted in the discovery of North America. We do a Michigan week type of unit. For example, one of my colleagues is working on one right now that will begin in a couple of weeks and run to the end of the year on Michigan. And the history, of course, is very important. We've got a very colorful history, as I'm sure you're aware. Unlike a lot of the other states or colonies, which more or less were admitted into the Union, and there they are, you know, we've had three flags flying over forts and the names. I think a guy could teach a great unit on Michigan just on the blasted names of the places. You know, Michigan, the word Michigan itself.
Do you know what that means? I don't even know what that means.
I'm not exactly sure what it means myself, but I think it's in terms of a place of many waters or something of that nature. We have, I don't know, I think it's about 11,000 lakes in Michigan, not counting the Great Lakes, and like a zillion miles of shoreline if you add them all up, you know. And Minnesota brags about being the land of 10,000 lakes, and here we have 11,000. We go into the idea of the tourist industry and how it is the second most important industry in Michigan behind, maybe it's the first now with the automobiles going to pot. But we have a pretty good time with it. Kids are pretty interested, of course, in where they live. And many of them, it's surprising, many of them know nothing of such places as the Upper Peninsula, preferring to think of it as in terms of being Wisconsin. Of course, they're not alone. Many of the UPers think of themselves as being Wisconsinians also. But we do attempt to make them a little bit aware of what their the background of their state, especially the historical background. You can't understand what's going on in the present if you don't understand what happened before.
What, can you think of any facts right offhand that when they study this area that really impressed them?
Well, let's see. I have to kind of remember what Sandy did. I know what I have done in past years. For example, of course, they're always impressed by the recreational opportunities. You know, Michigan is, of course, a Four Seasons a playground, as the Tourist Council would have you believe, and I guess it's true. Compared to other states, I think, kids get a feeling of really how lucky they actually are. There's something to do every season of the year, and down in Indiana or someplace where the closest thing to a lake is some farmer's farm pond, you know, the kids have cottages and things like this. The lumbering, a little bit about the lumbering industry has always amazed them, and the fact that the automobile industry, of course, is centered in Michigan, and even Saginaw is one of the primary producers, of course, of parts for automobiles. A lot of the kids whose fathers are employed by General Motors get a, you know, big kick out of this. You know, that Michigan puts the nation on wheels, and their dad helps do it. Some of the other things that probably impress them are the fact that Michigan had a fantastic fur trade at one time. They we were right in the center of a large number of a large concentration of animals just because of the way the river systems worked out. And of course, the best fur-bearing animals are aquatic animals, living their lives in water. Even of course, they breathe air, like beaver and mink and otter, animals that. It's a fact of life, an animal that lives its life on land just doesn't have a very good fur coat, and doesn't make a very good fur coat. Weasel and ermine. Told them one time that, they didn't believe me, they had to find out for themselves, but it was possible if a man were able to trap or to shoot in some manner a silver fox, that even in those days, he could get up to $1,500 for the one pelt. Yeah, that's right.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, up to $1,500 for the one pelt, which, you know, $1,500 is a lot right now, but it could be an entire year's supply of cash for the particular trapper who happened to come up with it. These were used, by the way, for a variety of things, but I imagine a coat would just be, the cost would be prohibitive. To buy a coat made of these, because it'd take probably 8 or 10 pelts. But I think they used them for muffs, ladies' muffs. You know, put their hands in because it was, you know, small enough. I'm not sure, but that possibly could be it. But many times I've heard stories of trappers forsaking an entire winter's catch of furs and jumping out of a canoe when they spot a silver fox, which, by the way, is a color phase of the red fox. Down by the shoreline of a river or something like that, you know, grabbing the old flintlock and chasing them, you know, because here's a year's supply worth of money. And this continued even into the trapping days in the Yukon and Canada and in Alaska. It's still very valuable. Ermine, of course, where the white color phase of the weasel is a very expensive pelt were you to buy one, but you have to have so many of them. Because they're just little fellas. I think the kids have always gotten a kick out of the idea of the way that trappers lived. You know, just hand to mouth, off the land. You know, survival in its true sense. And there are places in the world yet where people have to live this way. And some people even choose to live this way. But, you know, if he misses a shot of the moose, for example, he just doesn't happen to eat that day. One thing that I've always tried to impress on children that I have taught: when we look over the vast natural resources of Michigan, there's some things that they have to be taught. For example, we often think of the days of the pioneers, especially hunters and unfortunately anti-hunters in the United States, people who have, in my opinion, no conception of modern conservation practices or what foots the bill, license fees and special taxes paid by sportsmen. For example, Michigan's deer herd is 12 times larger now than when the first white man set foot on Michigan. That's right. Rough grouse, the king of game birds, as some of us believe, their numbers are 50 times greater now, estimated. Small ground-dwelling animals, such as rabbits and even squirrels, which of course depend upon not on a pine forest, but on a deciduous forest, oak trees and things like this. They are many, many times more numerous. And the reason, of course, is when you cut down the trees, you let sunlight to the forest floor and bushes grow. As a matter of fact, a large climax forest, whether it's beech maple forest or a pine forest such as the white pine, is a biological desert as far as animal life is concerned. Deer don't live in big woods, regardless of what Walt Disney would have you believe with Bambi and all the rest of it. Deer live in brush not much higher than your head. Mm-hmm. They have to browse on buds during the wintertime. And this is true. Just to give you an example, on a nationwide scale, Michigan's deer herd right now numbers 800,000. That is 300,000 more than were in the entire 48 contiguous states when the Pilgrims landed in 1620. It comes from cutting down the forest. And when you cut down the forest...
Do you think part of it could be, too, that we changed our eating habits? I mean, you know, back then there weren't a great big cattle herds mm-hmm. to be eaten, and a lot of it was venison then. Do you think that could have something to do with it, too?
Yes, possibly. However, we have sportsmen, especially conservation, United Conservation Clubs, of course, and people don't realize this, have always been the first ones to push for strong game laws. As a sportsman myself, it's only if I thought that hunting was killing off all the animals, that'd be like blowing up the tennis courts after you're done playing. You know, you'd be slicing your own throat. The animals who that were eaten, of course, deer, and but most often smaller animals, squirrels, and of course the animals. Otter is delicious. I've had otter before. Yeah, raccoon, woodchuck is very good. These animals that were trapped, of course, the farmer or the trapper would, you know, throw the carcass in his basket as well as the pelt. Of course, he'd skin them out when he got home. But regardless, these were eaten. But not only were the animals less numerous, but they were actually hunted with very primitive weapons. When you pulled the trigger on an old flintlock, you weren't real sure if it was going to go off or not. And if it did go off, you didn't know whether it was going to go pop or blow up in your face. I would say that the eating habits doesn't have that much to do. I think it's just good, solid conservation, which basically is this. Michigan's habitat can support 400,000 deer over a winter. If you have 900,000 in the fall, which we usually have, 500,000 are going to die. They will either starve, they'll be hit by automobiles, or they'll be taken by hunters who pay license fees, who pay special taxes on their guns and ammunition, which go to wildlife improvement. And I have seen deer starve to death, and it's not a pretty sight. Not just dead deer. I've seen them when their hindquarters go paralyzed, and a mercy killing is almost required, you know, like you would put a dog to sleep. And I've also seen deer that have been shot in the prime of their life. And a lot of criticism comes that, you know, well, the buck deer, you know, he's in the prime of his life, and if you shoot him, you remove him from the gene pool. Therefore, he won't reproduce other prime deer. As a matter of fact, an old buck deer, most deer are bred. The does are impregnated by very young bucks. The old buck is so crazy, trying to round up a harem, he doesn't have time to take care of them. A good book, by the way, has just been published on the life of the white-tailed deer, and it's very un-Walt Disney. It's very true to life. But Michigan is one of the, Michigan had the first conservation department, for example. It has a $75 million budget just for wildlife improvement and the paying of game officers. It's actually a real sportsman's paradise, and I try to get this across to my kids. Maybe it came across now, I don't know, but this is the type of thing that the kids seem to be interested in. They're not really too keyed about, you know, well, such things, little things, like if you told them, you know, that Saginaw is honeycombed with coal mines, you know. I can show you one over on Wilson Street where you can get right into a coal mine.
Oh, yeah? Gosh, yeah. I didn't know that.
Right over next to Mike Bernathy's house.
Oh.
Yeah, there's an old cave opening, and it runs out from there out through Saginaw Township.
Oh.
And out by the prairie farm, of course, where coal mining sections and iron, hematite especially, which is the higher grade rather than taconite, the lower grade ore, was mined around here. And, of course, that's really what got us started in the automobile industry, was we were that close to the raw materials. As the raw materials were exhausted, they already had the plants built, and transportation was better, so might as well stay.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but this has always been my impression, and I've really been disappointed in the fact that I don't think the Saginaw Valley did a whole lot to preserve their history. You know, there are very few of the original landmarks left, and I wondered if you had any reasons why. Because, like, Mackinac Island, it's really commercialized mm-hmm. now, but I enjoyed going there just to see a lot of the things that you can't find around here.
Yeah, as far as, yeah, I would agree with you. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. First of all, lying toward the eastern part of the United States, we were looked upon, I guess, as we were the second frontier, of course. The New England states were the first frontier, and then after the peace treaties were signed and we had land development acts of, I think, 1785, the Northwest Act, we became the new frontier. And then, of course, it was the West, and then finally the Great Plains. It was moving backwards. We kind of got left in the dust. People have a tendency, I guess, to forget about their history until it's almost too late. When they found themselves approaching the Pacific Coast, manifest destiny, you know, we have to be from coast to coast, they started to stop and think and say, hey, you know, we've got to preserve some of these things for our children, because I have always believed that land, natural resources, and your history are merely borrowed from your children. The people, well, for example, this is why I believe that such places as San Francisco and places in the Southwest are so big on their history, and they've taken efforts to preserve it, because we reached the saturation point of exploration in the United States. We said, hey, you know, we've got to preserve some of this. But meanwhile, Michigan was kind of shuffled in the background. And of course, as I said, tourism is a very important industry, and it's commercialized from a historical standpoint, but it is money in the pockets of almost everybody. And it helps taxpayers, I suppose. Every cent that goes into the till here in Michigan is maybe 1 cent less that we have to pay in federal or state taxes, at least. Not only that, a lot of people just aren't really interested in their heritage anyway. You know, if you got a weekend, so. Yeah.
Because that, I think it would have been a lot easier, at least, you know, from a classroom standpoint, if there was some place you could go, you know, something mm-hmm. really visual and not just.
Although, you know, that's not just limited to us. I don't know if you're aware of it or not, but many of the places in Boston, Massachusetts, you know, where things happened in famous buildings and things like this. The only thing left of them is a little plaque, a little gold plaque, mm-hmm. you know, in somebody's delicatessen telling you that in 1775, thus and so happened here. We've always been ones to look forward instead of backward. Places in Europe where old castles are still open to the public and have been standing for centuries, they're more aware of their culture. And I guess being a melting pot type of thing, which in some ways is good, but historically people have a tendency to want to forget what they left behind. Not just for coming from the old country to here, but going from the East Coast to the West Coast, which we still see.
Mm-hmm. When you present, if you were to present, you know, the history of the Saginaw Valley overall, would you take it from just one aspect, you know, like just the development of the resources here, or would you take it from the political development and put it in a perspective as a whole?
Yeah, I think whenever you develop history for young children, older people, college students, are able to, I hope, at least keep up with the changes that take place on all fronts, because history, of course, is not just limited to social history or political mm-hmm. history or even natural history, but instead is on a broad scope. On all fronts. Well, young kids, this is pretty hard for them to grasp. If you start out with, say, the natural history and take it, you know, the development of it, all the way through, say, ages of glaciation, up through formation of river systems, the gouging of the Great Lakes during the, I think it was the Wisconsin glacier period. I may be wrong. And move forward with this. With this point of view, and then go backward and say, all right, you know, it was, remember when we talked about the French trappers developing or coming along, what it was like.